I'm Carol Cure. I'm a campus minister at Ohio University. I direct an ecumenical ministry there and work part-time for the Lutherans but full-time for the United Ministries of Higher Education. I'm also a weaver, and I live on a farm with my husband and two teenage daughters, and it's there that I have my weaving studio. So while I'm here at Holden, I'm doing a combination of teaching as well as working with Corinne in the craft studio, teaching weaving. So I hope to see some of you down there. We could use some men down in the weaving studio, right? Okay, today we're going to consider prayer, and I've called the talk today Noisy Contemplation. And it sounds like a contradiction, noisy contemplation, and we'll get into why that is. I'd like us to, for the first maybe 15 minutes or so, talk about what prayer is, how we define that, and then the process of prayer, and then after that, developing some skills in contemplation. And I have a few slides that will be sort of springboards for contemplation. I am offering also during the time I'm here, I'll be here for about a month, workshops on drawing and seeing. And drawing doesn't mean that you have to be an artist. Drawing is that you use drawing as a meditative tool, as well as on journaling, how to keep a spiritual journal. And so I won't go into detail on those today, but those are aspects of this whole notion of prayer. I have relied very heavily in preparing for today upon two books. And the first one is on Becoming a Musical Mystical Bear. It's over in the bookstore, and if you haven't read it, I would recommend it as a really excellent introduction to the thinking of Matthew Fox, who was a Roman Catholic spiritual leader. On Becoming a Musical Mystical Bear. It's a really wild title. A lot of his books have really strange titles, but they're very profound books. And he relies upon a lot of the mystical thinkers from way back when until now and draws them together in a very coherent way. It's also pretty reasonably priced, $3.45. Matthew Fox. Mm-hmm. Then, this is also called a book, and it's printed this way because it's available to everybody at like 25 cents cost, but when you read through it, fine print, it would really make a fine little book, and he calls this the book, Noisy Contemplation, by William Callahan. And Bill Callahan directs the Don Quixote Center in Maryland, which is a center for spiritual development. I would encourage all of you later on to come up and get the address for the Quixote Center. They will regularly send you for $1.50 a year anything that comes out from their center, and a lot of it are really fine exercises on how to develop your spiritual life. So come and take a look at this later, but I've relied pretty heavily upon these two authors, and I wanted to credit them properly at the beginning. Well, I suppose whenever you prepare a talk or whenever you even prepare your own life's vocation, what you're doing are answering questions that you're asking. I think that physicians go into medicine because they're you know, troubled by things in their body, or that, you know, as a minister, I went into the ministry because I obviously was asking spiritual questions, and the seminary was a place for me to try to find the answers. So likewise with today's talk, I guess I'm talking about prayer and interested in that because it's always puzzled me. It's never been an easy thing for me. It's been very difficult for me to pray. And that path, that search for prayer, has taken me through all kinds of disciplines. I've learned yoga, and I have learned journaling, and I've learned drawing, seeing, meditation, and silent meditation, and guided imagery. And name the thing, I've been to the workshop that's taught it. And I believe in all of those things. I think they're excellent aids. The thing that has puzzled me most throughout my life has been that phrase, pray without ceasing. And I remember as a kid, I'd walk down the street and I was trying to be so faithful to my God, and I'd be saying my prayers over and over again. And then, you know, you can't do that at the same time you're doing something else. And I thought, my word, now what does that mean, pray without ceasing? I am still struggling with what that means, although I think I'm coming closer to it. And what I want to share with you today is what I think can be the kernel for that. I think that the disciplines that I have learned by going to retreat centers, and I frequently go to a Marianist center in Dayton, Ohio, to do spiritual retreats, those things are wonderful, and Holden is wonderful, and all the retreat centers that we go to and the retreats we have in churches are wonderful, but they're essentially for affluent people. They're affluent disciplines that take money. You have to pay a registration fee, you go, you have to take time out from work, and these aren't things that lots of people can do. I live in the heart of Appalachia. My brothers and sisters who work in the mines there can't take time off like I can to go off for a weekend retreat. So it's puzzled me as to how to find a prayer medium or a way to pray that is not affluent, that's not an affluent discipline dependent upon money and special time, although I think those are things that are still okay. So this is where Bill Callahan has been helpful to me at the Don Quixote Center. They are committed to developing prayer that is so simple that anybody can do it. You don't have to be educated. You don't even have to be literate to do it. Prayer should be so portable that it can be taken into the jail cell or it can be taken into the hospital. It should not be dependent upon a lot of fancy accoutrements. It should be for the ordinary, the poor, the uneducated, and the insecure, as well as the affluent, like most of us are. It should also be for the activist who is so busy doing social justice work that at the press in the end of the day or at the beginning of the day, there isn't time to take out a large block of time. And I would imagine that some of you, in answering these questions, found that one of the most troublesome things about prayer is that you just don't have time to do it. Did that occur to anybody, that it's very difficult to find the time? Yeah, don't take time or can't find time. Yeah.
That means you've got to quit everything and sit down.
Then, right, then you don't.
Then it takes time.
Right, okay. Right, good. Well, we'll get into what it can mean or what it doesn't mean. Prayer, as far as I'm concerned, and I think as far as Bill Callahan is concerned, should start in the middle of your life. It's not time that you just set aside. So wherever you are, that's where prayer can occur. And it can occur very simply. So, the theme for this week, for this whole summer, I guess, is called the Feast of Life. How are we called to live? Matthew 22 says, "You must love your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. You must love your neighbor as yourself." These four things that are mentioned are not only the key to how we're to live. I did it. It's also the key to how we contemplate a prayer. The essentials of loving God deeply, loving our near neighbors, meaning our family and our friends and the people we deal with every day at work, loving ourselves, and loving our far neighbors, those whom we don't even know, are the key to how we're called to live as Christians and how we are to contemplate and pray. Prayer, the basis for prayer should be found in the content of our own lives. It's not found in the content of some mystics or some special people somewhere else. The basis for your prayer should be found in the midst of your own vocation, wherever you are, and with the contacts you have, your near neighbors, and even your far neighbors. To live is what prayer is all about. Prayer is not saying prayers. Prayer is not talking to God. It's not getting on the heavenly hotline and letting your concerns be known. Prayer is not pious postures, not ways of putting your body into certain shapes. Prayer is not liturgy. It's not ecstatic experiences. It's not a duty. There's no duty to pray, and there's no penalty for not praying. Prayer is an invitation. It's like being invited to a feast. There's no duty, there's no obligation, you're not punished if you don't go. You are just less rich. You are less well fed if you don't go. So, to live is what prayer is all about, and to engage life. My husband always says that his life is his prayer. My husband very rarely takes time to do the spiritual disciplines I do, but he keeps talking about how his life is his prayer. It's not a complete definition, but it certainly is accurate as far as it goes. Prayer is a response to life, and this response comes individually from each of us, and it comes corporately from the whole Christian community. Now, there are two dimensions. Prayer is a response to life from your own psychological self. And this is what we call the mystical or contemplative aspect of prayer, or dimension of prayer would be better. Then there's also a social dimension of prayer, and that's the prophetic dimension. And all of us spend our lives moving, all of us, our Christian lives, moving back and forth between the mystical, contemplative prayer life and that which is social and prophetic. and which we do with the community of believers. And one feeds upon the other. What we find in our own lives and how we respond to the invitation to life from God will affect how we respond to the invitation to life from the whole community or within the whole community. Now, my very favorite definition of prayer. I didn't want to put this out because any of you would steal it before I showed it to you. To pray is to fall ever more deeply in love with life. It's just the most incredible thing. To re-fall in love all of the time. I mean, you know how it was when we all first fell in love. Well, to re-fall in love with life all of the time is the essence of what prayer is all about. And that means re-falling in love with our near neighbors, with our family, with our friends, with those we've worked. It's re-falling in love with ourselves all the time, re-appreciating who we are, the incredible creations that we are. It is re-falling in love with our far neighbors, those who are at a distance from us. And in the process of doing that, we are loving God, because God is life. And to respond to life is to respond to God in the midst of every day, not necessarily just in time set aside. We know God by responding to life. Meister Eckhart, who was the mystic of the early centuries, said that God is isness. God is the essence of all that there is. And this is very much a creation-centered concept of prayer. That wherever we find life, we're going to find God. Now, I know when I was in the seminary at UNI, you learned you don't find God in nature and you don't find God this way and that way. I'm not so sure about that. I think we find God within all of life. It's within all of creation. And I think we need to rethink some of the theology about that. Well, how did Jesus pray? Jesus used the analogy of life constantly when he was speaking of the kingdom of God. I prefer to use the phrase New Age for obvious reasons. The kingdom of God has a sexist imagery for me, but so kingdom of God or New Age, whatever it is that happened at the point where Jesus entered history and has now proclaimed a new age to us, which we will find in fulfillment of the resurrection, but in which we now participate. In that kingdom, the imagery Jesus used was that of life. His parables talk about throwing seed on the ground to grow, to live. Seeds growing into trees. Vines bearing branches. Women looking for lost coins. Women doing their everyday work. Men throwing nets to sea. Family relationships. Those moments when we find Jesus at prayer in the New Testament are the moments when he was responding to his own real life situation. I always have a hard time with the prayer of the church because it seems to just take everything into one fell swoop and you manage to get it all out of the way in about 30 seconds or a minute and a half. It doesn't seem to me as though the prayer of the church responds to real life situations. It's like a catch-all. That when we find Jesus at prayer, we find him praying over the fact that his disciples weren't being faithful to him. Or we find him praying that he would have death, that he would not have to face death. Or we find him praying when he was tempted. He was praying in the midst of his own existential situation, his own life. So indeed, our prayer must be what our problems are with our neighbors, with ourselves, with our far neighbors. Our prayers should come out of our life and be reflections upon the action we're already involved in life. God is everywhere all the time. We are invited to seek God everywhere because God seeks us everywhere. God seeks us when we're cleaning the toilet bowl, and God seeks us when we're out driving a truck, and God seeks us when we're walking in nature, and God seeks us when we're in pious positions of prayer. God seeks us everywhere because God is everywhere. To respond to life everywhere is to respond to God, to respond to the creator of life. So to pray without ceasing is a process of becoming alive and becoming aware. There's this little
saying that we read the other day when I was teaching the drawing class. Millions of people unseeing, joyless, bluster through life in their half-sleep. Hitting, kicking, killing. What they have barely perceived. They have never learned to see. I believe that if we would really see, that if we were really aware, if we were really responding to life, we wouldn't have an arms race. We wouldn't have an arms race. We wouldn't allow ourselves. We would withdraw our consent. We would withdraw our tax money. We would withdraw our consent to the forces of evil if we were really seeing. Because when we really see God in all of creation, we can't allow that creation to be destroyed. We simply can't allow it. And so I think that our perception, our prayer life, is directly connected to the success of what we would call life forces. So the process to pray is a process of becoming alive. It's the process of rooting ourselves in life. And the process goes something like this. I'm sure there are many other stages, but these are the ones that I thought of anyway. The process is both, as I mentioned before, individual. There's a psychological response to the process, and there's a social. Now I'm just going to read them over and then maybe elaborate upon them. First of all is this awareness. The awareness of everything about us is part of the process of beginning to learn how to pray. Then is the freedom to let ourselves go, to accept ourselves for the limited, sinful, awful, wonderful creatures that we are. To not pretend that we're somebody else, and to not try to mold somebody else into what they aren't. Learning to pray means that you accept and that I accept the imperfections in each other, and that we don't try to put ourselves into some kind of a Christian mold. That we begin to appreciate and savor all of life. And that means that we learn to appreciate and savor and integrate into ourselves the painful times. I've received a letter from home this week, which was very, very painful. It's not for me to reject that. It's for me to integrate that into me. That's a part of my life. I have to learn to integrate that and take it into myself and appreciate that that's a part of life also. The process then leads to a change of heart or a conversion. And that is the conversion of becoming a lover of life. If we begin to become so aware and we begin to accept ourselves and others and we begin to appreciate and savor life, we will then become a lover of life. And our whole manner of being will be converted. We will be changed people. We will be renewed people. Then there is the social dimension. We don't just respond as individuals to the call of God to the feast of life. We respond as a community, and we respond to the community. So we have to sometimes do some tearing up, and we have to sometimes do some knocking down. We have to discern where there is trouble in the world. And we have to be very honest about that. We have to be honest about the fact that there's a lot of stuff going on in our communities that needs life, that needs help. And so sometimes we have to tear up things and knock them down. We have to develop a prophetic vocation. Matthew Fox says that everybody who is an adult has a prophetic call, that we all have a call to be prophets. And some people say, you know, that some are teachers, some are prophets, some are teachers, some are this or that. But he doesn't let anybody off the hook in this category. He says that we all need to have a vocation which creates and which says no to the enemies of life. And however you want to name the enemies of life, they're all around us. And that every adult has that responsibility to sometimes say no. And that is a part of our prayer life. In the midst of taking action to say no to that which is evil and that which is horrible in life, we begin to reflect upon that and we begin to discern God's will, and that's where prayer comes in. This model follows a lot the notion of liberation theology. Liberation theology says that we as Christians go out into the world and we act, we respond to life right where it is, and then we reflect upon it. Then we pray about it. Then we come together to figure out what's going on. We don't, first of all, gather together in our churches and get everything straight in our heads, and then go out to do social action, which is what I was taught as a Luther leader, I remember that. You figure it all out, you get it all straight, you get your doctrine straight, you get your ethics straight, and then you go out and you implant that on the world. Liberation theology does it just the other way around. You start with where you are, you respond as a person to your own situation, and then you come together and reflect and act. And that's what this is about. That the development of the prophetic vocation is that we throw ourselves, we immerse ourselves in life, and then in the process of doing that and seeking justice, we will begin to have the gift of discernment promised to us through the Holy Spirit. If we do that, if we're involved in all of this, we will learn what it means to embrace suffering. Not only the suffering that comes to us, as a mother I'm suffering, maybe as a husband or a wife you're suffering, maybe as a father or mother you're suffering. We all have to accept the suffering that comes to us. But furthermore, we are called to follow our Lord, and that means that we are to take up suffering. Not that we're to become masochistic, but that we are to do as our Lord did, to risk everything, to be willing to say, in the process of seeking justice for ourselves and others, that perhaps we will even risk death. And that's what I think the peace movement's going to take. It's going to take people who are willing to say no to the death machine, no to the death machine, so that others may live. And we are called, as adult Christians, to be a part of that prophetic community. That is our prayer. Our prayer is not on Sunday morning gathering together to say the prayers, "Oh Lord, give us peace." It is to immerse ourselves, to throw ourselves into the situation and do what we can and expect God's Spirit to be there with us. That is the prayer. Now, let's see where I am here. So, as I said before, prayer is moving back and forth between solitude, between this response and the response of the community. It's a moving back between mysticism, your times of silence, your times of contemplating the very tiny parts of nature or the parts of your own body I was telling the group the other day, I've been taking to drawing my husband's feet. He doesn't know it, but as he sits on his hassock at night, I've wanted to know another part of him. So he doesn't know, but while he's reading his paper, I'm drawing his feet. It's a moving back and forth between those small little details and appreciations of the lines of life to also the prophetic part of life. We'll continually be immersed in both. It's the response between the social and the individual. All of it being a response to the feast of life. Well, how do we do this? And I'm not pretending for a moment that I have all the answers on this. I found that we develop the prayer process by contemplation. We certainly develop it by all the things we've always done, by being faithful at the Eucharist, by doing our prayers at the table, by doing our evening prayers, by our daily devotions, all those things which we all have done in the rear as Lutherans. I think we continue those. But in addition, we develop the process of deep prayer, the kind of prayer that will sustain us through very difficult times, by learning how to do contemplation. And there are a number of steps here, and I'm going to read these over, and then I'm going to describe one section, and then show you a few slides, and ask you to contemplate on those, and then I'm going to read another section, and so we'll be turning the lights off and on, but not yet. Okay. We develop a prayer process by developing our external senses, by contemplating the earth and our civilization. That means that we learn to close our eyes and to hear what's about us, that we learn to shut off our other senses and hear what's about us, that we learn to see, very carefully learn to see, that occasionally we take times for silence, that we develop all of the senses about us. I mean, you've heard of examples where people who are cut off, when their senses are cut off, they die. And so if we're cutting off our senses, we're in the midst of some part of death of our own selves. So to live and to be fully alive and respond in prayer, we develop our external senses. And I'm not going to get into a lot of detail on this because I'm doing a whole separate workshop on it. But if any of you can't be in the workshop or whatever, then come to me and I'd be glad to work with you on techniques for developing your external senses. Then we develop our internal senses. That means that we develop empathy for each other. And we develop intuition towards the needs of others. And that we develop compassion. We use our senses to read people, to read when they're in pain, to read when they're in joy and celebrate with them. You know, we do this very well when we have small children because they are so dependent upon us. We read their every need and we're aware of the fact that we have to do that. And so we read when that child is hungry or we read when that child is having something, maybe a wet diaper or whatever. We know that. But we stop doing that when they grow up. And when we first fall in love, whenever that is, when we're young children, I guess, and then the adolescent love, we read each other. I mean, you can see kids looking lovingly into each other's eyes when they're just reading each other. They're really carefully listening to each other. But as our relationships mature, quote unquote, we forget to do that. And so we don't contemplate each other. And that's what contemplation is. It's taking time, being very intentional about seeing the other person in front of you. My husband and I have taken to, whenever we enter a room with each other, to gaze at each other for a moment. Because we'd forgotten how to do that. When I first married him, I used to gaze at him all the time. And then I stopped gazing at him. Something was missing. When we contemplate, we gaze at other people and we appreciate the lines, the loveliness of them. Maybe the potch that's growing when they're getting older, but we appreciate the fact that we are all unique creatures. Now, we need to intentionally do that. That's what noisy contemplation is about, intentionally remembering to contemplate. As we do that, we will become more empathetic. We will learn to be more compassionate because we will see what's going on in people's lives. Okay. Now, I would like to show two sets of slides. They're not long, but while I'm showing them, think about your external senses, how you would respond to the first set of slides, which are going to be mostly nature slides or slides of cities, and the second set of slides, how you would feel, how you would develop empathy and intuition and compassion for the people that I'm going to show you in the slides. And then we'll talk more about how we contemplate God and how we contemplate ourselves. The Feast of Life right before our very eyes. In looking at individuals and contemplating those near to us and those far to us, we need to contemplate broken love. All of us experience in our life love that becomes broken. And we need to contemplate forgiveness. We need to contemplate our anger, not ignore our anger, not ignore our hurt. We need to contemplate what reconciliation means. I'm having a difficult time with my teenage daughter right now. So I'm taking her picture, and I contemplate her picture. Now, I could think about her all day long, and I've talked to some of you about the time I'm having with her. That's not contemplation. That certainly is working out difficulty. But to contemplate her, I have to put her before me in a very special, intentional way. I have to look at her face, and I have to think about her in a special way. That's contemplation. It is becoming very intentional about my ability to communicate or not communicate with her. Wherever we have hurt or difficulty in our lives, or wherever we have tremendous joy in our lives, let's contemplate that, put it before us, and make it special. And that doesn't mean we have to go off to a retreat center to do that. It doesn't mean even we have to take out 10:30 every night. You can do it while you're on the bus. You can take out a picture of a loved one, or you can take very special moments sandwiched within the day to contemplate. That's a part of praying without ceasing, that your whole day is interspersed. Sometimes when I'm sitting waiting at a stoplight, I find myself praying. I'm not even aware of the fact that I'm praying, and all of a sudden it occurs to me. Something has been breathing within me. A prayer has been there, sort of underneath, and it bubbles up when there's a moment. And I think the more we do that,
the more it becomes just a part of the way we live. It breathes in and out of us. So we also need to establish habits of respectful touching. It's a part of the senses which we don't use very often. I met a nun the other day. We were involved in watching the same slideshow. And I maybe never will see her again, but we were discussing the situation in El Salvador, and she came up and she just very gently touched my hand. She was contemplating me at that moment. I knew that I was what was before her at that very moment. When you are in a state of contemplation, the very moment you are in is the only moment. It's the moment that is special. It is the moment given to you by God at that point to appreciate. And so often, you know, we're thinking 2 days ahead or 2 hours ahead or 5 months behind, rather than contemplating the very moment we are in. Respectful touching of people that you're with can let them know that you are really with them at that moment. I find that the best way for me to contemplate others is through a journal. And a journal keeping allows you to be very angry or very hurtful or very much in love or whatever, and to allow that to come out in a way that nobody else is going to have to see ever. In fact, my journal right now, as I left to come to Holden, my journal is in the care of my best friend. I brought it to her the night before I left. After I made my last entry, I said, if I die on the plane, burn it. And she will. She'll promise that she'll burn my journal. I would not want my family to read that journal, because there I have let out, in a safe way, all the stuff that really bothers me. The journal method that I use, and which I'm going to teach next week, is the kind where you dialogue with a situation, you dialogue with a job, you dialogue with people, you even dialogue with God. And the dialogue goes two ways. You go into a slightly altered meditative state, and then you simply allow to come out of you all that's there without thinking. And then you allow the person, the job, God, whatever it is, to respond back to you. So it's a dialogue situation. It's an excellent technique for learning how to contemplate others and yourself. I would recommend it. If you ever have a chance to go to a journal workshop, take yourself up on that. Okay, contemplating ourselves is, I think, the most difficult thing, because it's very hard for us to appreciate ourselves. And for us to concentrate on who we are is a tough thing. But I guess that's what I've been saying. We need to concentrate on that. We need to admit that we're not perfect, but that we are pretty wonderful. We really are. And that part of contemplating ourselves is appreciating ourselves. I mean, wake up some morning and just go before the mirror and say, oh boy, are you gorgeous? And just allow yourself to appreciate yourself. Because that, you know, put yourself in the situation. And what if Jesus was meeting with you somewhere in a room? How would he behold you? Chances are he would behold you with tremendous love. That the gaze Jesus would give you as he contemplated you would be one of total acceptance, even though there was all these flaws. And I think sometimes we need to sort of use visual imagery that way. Image what it would mean to have Jesus in the midst of a situation you find troublesome. And I think we're learning to appreciate ourselves more. Another way of contemplating ourselves that's been helpful to a number of people across the centuries has been to find a spiritual director. Now, spiritual directors are very common in the Roman Catholic world, but even there, a lot of the laity are separated from this idea. Spiritual directors become sort of directors of those who become spiritual leaders, and there's sort of a hierarchy. I'm developing in our ministry the notion of a prayer partner. And what I do is get two students together, and it's got to be somebody they feel comfortable with, comfortable really sharing all these things with. And then you help each other. You set aside some discipline, for instance, that you will each day remember to contemplate this or that, or that you will each day remember to take a certain time for prayer, or you know, whatever you contract for. And then your prayer partner meets with you weekly, and you just sort of say what happened. But that person can be objective enough and outside of you enough to help you when you're stuck or whatever. So a prayer partner is one way of developing the ability to contemplate ourselves. It would really be nice if we could do it like they did in China with the barefoot doctor system, where they didn't have enough physicians and they trained lay people to do that. If we could train more lay people to help each other become spiritual directors. Because I think most people feel pretty lost. Like, who am I? How could I guide somebody in their spiritual life? Mine's such a shambles. if we would do more training like that and then get people in all the congregations doing this, I think it would help us immensely. And that is to image. We did a wonderful job of imaging last night during Mary Schramm's sermon, her talk. I was almost in tears as I imaged that young boy going on to that bus and all the people taunting him. We also did a wonderful job of imaging when Larry did the service the other night where we had the flags up and he would talk a little bit about each country. That is imaging, and that was an example of imaging our far neighbors. If we could do that more often, to image and to contemplate our far neighbors means that we need to know something about that situation. If we want to image the people in South Africa, it would behoove us to learn something about South Africa, but then to take a real-life situation as much as you can if you've read about it and image yourself into that situation. What would it be like to have somebody, some security force, come to your house at night and drag away somebody in your family? Put yourself into that situation, or put that situation into your own life. What would it mean for you to be there, or what would it mean to have that situation imposed upon your life? I think that kind of deliberate, intentional imaging will help us to become more compassionate people. And doing that in services of worship, like it's been done here, I think is excellent. And we ought to do more of that. So if you're working on your worship committee at home, you might suggest that some more of that imaging be done. And you can certainly do that imaging with slides. You can do that imaging with music also. The arts are very helpful in helping us to find ways to image compassion for others. There's a program where you can, a congregation or a peace group can adopt a family in the Soviet Union, and you write back and forth. And that's another way of getting in touch with compassion for our far neighbors. To contemplate them is to actually have a family to write to. And a lot of you probably have adopted children through Christian Children's Fund or some of those things. That's another way to contemplate another individual who's a far neighbor. There's lots of ways of doing that. But to keep it before us is what we need to do. To keep it before us, we need to contemplate them. Now, contemplating God, I think, is done by all of the above. We do indeed contemplate God, and we find God in the midst of contemplating our neighbors and our friends and ourselves. We also, obviously, contemplate God through the Eucharist and the other sacraments. We also contemplate God when we're quiet. I have a lot of Quaker friends, and I had never done much silent meditation before I met them. But indeed, that's a way of contemplating God that we have not allowed ourselves much in our tradition, to be very still and to listen. Thomas Merton said, my vocation is to be silent. God is speaking. My vocation is to be silent. All of us need to have some silence. And even though I'm advocating noisy contemplation in the midst of your life, take time for silence is also a very important thing in contemplating God. The conclusion of all this is that if we trust our own lives, if we trust our own experiences, if we throw ourselves into life, that we will find God's Spirit working in our own daily lives. I think it's a temptation always to say that God's working through somebody else, that God's working through the pastor or the Christian education director or someone else who's just a little bit better than we are. We must trust that God is working through our lives and that the feast of life is there and that we are to take hold of it. If we do that, I think we will enter more deeply into life, we will become compassionate, and we will have the ability to learn how to risk, maybe even to risk our own lives. So I'd like to just show the last set of slides, which is about far neighbors, and see if you can put yourself somewhat into the situation that you see. The way, something I think you can do if you're talking about prayer in your own church or whatever. Are there any questions or thoughts that people have as to how this notion differs from what you might have been taught, or
Can this go on?
What do you want us to give from?
Well, these slides, I don't necessarily want you to get anything from them except the fact that this is a way to look at things you're not totally familiar with, and to learn how to really see what's there is the basis of contemplation.
The last superimposed square.
It was, yeah, uh-huh. But superimposed underneath it was the was a peasant home, and I could see when I looked at it.
That was,
yeah.
Cool, right?
Yes, it was. You're right. The idea is to be so aware of life that when we move into strange situations, we really see. Because sometimes when we move into strange situations, we like close in on ourselves and we're not open. The idea is to be open to everything, open to people, open to cities, open to sand, open to wind, open to, you know, distress, horror, death, everything, to be open to it. And that is being open to life, which is being open to God. It's not, prayer is not closing in on yourself in a posture which is like this and telling God all your problems. Prayer essentially is being open to all that's there. So that's what I was wanting people to get out of the slides. And I knew it would be perplexing, and I was hoping somebody would say, what's this all about? Is there another question?
I have
a couple
of college students that take it.
Yeah,
How do they respond to this type of thing? Do you see it growing and developing and finding out?
Yeah, they're very much interested in learning different techniques, like the journal keeping or the meditation. I have good response to people learning different kinds of meditation techniques. And when I offer meditation course, I'll offer three or four kinds of techniques, because not everybody likes drawing, seeing, and not everybody likes the kind where you simply concentrate it with a mantra and say it over and over. But usually you can find one thing that people, and they want something they can get a hold of. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they're using things that they haven't learned, as, you know, coming up to school.
Have you heard that, oh, this always stuck with me, you never really live unless you know you're going to die. I mean, in the time frame.
Uh-huh.
Have you experienced people with that sentence that have come to you with a better insight on prayer?
Yes. Go ahead. Okay. Repeat it again. She wants to hear
you.
Yeah, she couldn't hear you.
Oh, okay. I've heard it said that you never really live unless you know you're going to die in the time frame, 6 months of your life. And I was just wondering if she has ever encountered anybody from her that wants to know some better insight on prayer. And of course, I've talked to people that have at that time frame, and they really begin to like and know what it's about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just buried a girl about 2 weeks ago. She was about 28 and had an illness that nobody could explain. But she knew she was dying, but nobody would believe her. I mean, all her doctors, I mean, they couldn't define it, so nobody would tell her she was dying, but she knew she was dying. And she started keeping a journal. And the journal was an incredible thing for her because she was able to get all of this out, but she did begin to appreciate life also. It was amazing to see the growth that took place in her in the last 6 months before she died. But the perplexing thing for her was that nobody believed she would die. And in fact, she died sitting in the living room talking with her husband and another couple. And she got faint and she said, I'm dying. And she died. She died that morning. But nobody would believe her. And so her struggle was very much of a lonely one, except for a few of us who were with her. Yeah, I think that's probably true. Okay, well, I guess it's almost lunchtime.